Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, and Tony Hall of Alaska Newspapers. We're at noon on Friday when we're recording, and the big news right now is Sarah Palin's emails, which were released this morning in Juneau in boxes and boxes and boxes, and journalists around the world are pouring over them. Steve, give us the overview. Tell us, what is the significance of the word redacted?
I would tell you, but my whole statement's been redacted, so you might want to go on to Paul. Well, I think it's a very significant point in here. The state's gone in, and I guess it was the state's attorney general's office has gone in and redacted a number of items that have been mentioned in these emails. And I don't know how extensive. I guess until we really all get a chance to see what the emails contain and how much has been erased or blacked out, I guess. But there were things of personal nature. They said that they would redact medical issues, family issues, things along those lines that those would remain private. So anything mentioned along those
I saw those a number veins, of pages that had something to do with Steve Blanchflower that were blank.
Yeah.
Except for the fact that they had something to do with Blanchflower.
Yeah, which is kind of a significant player in all of this too. It's just, you know, they've been lying around for a couple of years now, and everybody got a chance to see these things before they went out. All the the players, the attorneys, and some of the people mentioned in these emails, including, I'm sure, former Governor Palin. So, you know, I don't know. I'm not really sure what's been redacted. You know,
we're going to come back to you, but I can see Paul Jenkins is
bursting at the seams,
seams, chomping at the bit to comment.
I'm very excited about this. Now, this is one of those things. I think the media from all around the nation has got its hands full just digging through stuff that normally they wouldn't pay an ounce of attention to. And you have to wonder how much attention any of us should pay to it. It's been almost 3 years since they were requested. They went through the government's lawyers. They were then sanitized, scrubbed by the governor's office, where people that work for Governor Sarah Palin still work for the governor who was her lieutenant governor. Before any of these things were released, they sent the boxes of them to a Fairbanks lawyer representing Palin. They didn't do anything to it. They didn't ask for anything. We should trust these things.
Can you tell us about the boxes? Many of us are wondering, why didn't the Parnell administration get this online some way?
Well, the claim, there's a Mother Jones piece out of all things detailing their
leftist,
commies, but nonetheless, detailing their attempts to get these things. And it changes all the time throughout the history of this. We don't have the money, we don't have the people, we're confused, we don't know what to do, our cars won't start. There's all kinds of stuff in these things, why they couldn't do it. But you have to ask yourself, in a state with a $30 billion permanent fund, $15 billion sitting in jackpots all around the state, $3 billion capital fund, and probably a $9 to $12 billion budget, we don't have a couple million dollars to sort out a computer system that will take data and put it redacted if necessary, and then redacted is just another way to say, you ain't seeing this, and put it on a DVD.
Or
in a timely fashion.
Or heaven forbid, this was brought up, I think, as all these emails were being transacted, have been being sent around. It was called to people's attention. Maybe we shouldn't even have gotten to that point. The state's business should be conducted in public, and it should be recorded.
Open and transparent, brother.
I've heard that someplace before.
Oh, yeah.
Who said that?
If I might, I thought I'd comment a little bit on the what some people might regard as a media circus, others would regard as intense media attention. I got to the Anchorage Daily News this morning and I had a call waiting for me from NBC, then the CBC called, the BBC, a radio station in Los Angeles, any number of media people who wanted to know what the story was. And the story was at that point is there might be a story or there might not be a story, depending on what was in the the boxes. And of course, then there's the whole business about going to get the boxes, picking them up, taking them to the airport, or I guess in the case of the New York Times, setting up a scanner in Juneau and scanning them. And you have many people running hither and yon very rapidly. I read about 65 of the emails before I came over here. That's all I could get at that point and all I had time for. The first one told Governor Palin that Jimmy or Bobby or somebody was coming in to repair her computer, and her computer would be gone for a second, for quite a while. Second email told Governor Palin that Al and Linda would be selling fry bread in the lobby of the Capitol, and if we were lucky, there might also be some tamales, enchiladas, or some other Mexican delicacy that would go with them. That John Katz sent her, the governor's representative in Washington, D.C., sent her emails updating her on what President Bush was up to with various policy initiatives. There were congratulatory letters to Governor Palin for the passage of AGEA. There were congratulatory letters for her running for vice president. And there was a whole bunch of stuff that had something to do with Steve Branchflower and his legalistic investigations that I couldn't figure out because it wasn't there. Mm-hmm. What you really got was a sense of, a small sense of, this is everyday business in the state of Alaska, and not unusual. I had predicted to my colleagues that there would be an email in there in which the grounds crew announced that the parking lot would be closed for snow removal. I'm still going to look for that one. And of course, I would have to say, and I think, Steve, I'd turn it over to you, but doesn't that seem to you that, you know, if there are 24,000 pages, one half of 1% would be 120. If there are 120 that are in some way critical, inflammatory, something of that nature, you can get a story that'll confirm whatever you want to believe.
I think so. You know, you have to look for context. There may be one email out there that people will glom onto and try and make a story out of that. Is that going to be fair? Is that going to be accurate? Is it going to be really put in context? Unless there were a whole series of those, some of the emails that we've seen are basically ripping on the media. That kind
for example,
of
thing. Channel 2.
Oh yeah, we've been mentioning a few of them. I think I've got mentioned in a couple as well as just some. We were at loggerheads with her public relations people over the handling of some stories and whether or not we could wait in the lobby of the Atwood building for a comment about something during Troopergate, that whole thing. You know, we wanted to get their side of the story on a development that day, and they were quite upset the fact that our photographer and our reporter decided to wait in the lobby so they could get their side of the story before airtime. It was getting late, and we had the impression that they were pushing us up. So that's part of an email trail as well. So.
Let's move on here, but we have more Palin, and I do want to get Tony Hall in here pretty soon. But first, Steve, the bus tour. Mm-hmm. What conclusions can we draw about that, if any?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I really don't know. She's not ready to announce what she's going to be doing. You'd think anybody who takes off from Washington, D.C. and travels to New Hampshire, a significant state for primaries, you would think that there would be an announcement at the end of the road. There wasn't. She apologized for stepping on Mitt Romney's big event up there in New Hampshire, where he announced. But you know, really, other than a history lesson on Paul Revere's ride, I don't know how much we got out of that. She certainly rekindled the base. Like, if that was her goal, she certainly got a ton of media attention. Got a lot of media out of it. And anything she does, she's gonna get a lot of media attention. And this was a big thing, a bus ride through New England into New Hampshire, and it got a lot of attention. So if that's what she wanted to do, she did it, and she did it well.
Let's get Paul Jenkins in here for one final time on Sarah Palin, and then we're going to go to Tony Hall. Paul, I'm asking you this because your name is Paul, as in Paul Revere.
Okay.
How did Sarah Palin generate a mini controversy in her attempt to praise the man who raised the alarm in 75 and is immortalized in Longfellow's poem?
She was asked a question about Paul Revere, and somehow when you read what she said, if you can make it out, with guns or not taking our dogs, you know, whatever it was about, comes down to she says Paul Revere was making this ride very loudly, you know, ringing bells all along the way, raising all kinds of cane, and basically to warn the British, too, that we were coming. And historians say, well, know, he would have ridden quietly because he was trying to alert Adams and Hancock to get the heck out of Dodge because the Brits were coming. He wouldn't have been yelling the British are coming because they're all British.
And Stephen Colbert and other wags thinks she's somehow confused with Paul Revere and the Raiders, right?
Maybe, yeah. You know, Revere, when he finally got snatched, he got bagged by the Brits, and he told them, hey, you guys let me go. There's 500 people coming, 500 militiamen, and you guys are dead men. And somehow, the most favorable look at this by a historian is, well, she was obliquely kind of right, maybe, in one little part.
and meanwhile, Wikipedia got okay, Tony Hall. Housing discrimination isn't something that most people experience these days, but that's not true for Alaska Natives, as one of your staff members found out. Can you tell us about this interesting, unusual light on something that most of us think is from the past?
Yeah, it was interesting, Michael, that this happened at the same time we're working on special coverage that we're going to be doing commemorating the 100th anniversary of Elizabeth Peratrovich's birthday. Elizabeth, most would remember, was responsible largely for the state's anti-discrimination law coming into being in 1945, the first such law in the United States. Well, in this particular case, this involved Stacy Deacon, who does work for Alaska newspapers. Stacy, though, was just trying to find a two-bedroom apartment in Anchorage for herself, her three-year-old daughter, and her companion. Found an apartment, liked it, got along with the landlord. The landlord said, go ahead and have the electricity turned on in your name and we'll set a date for signing the lease. Well, they set a date and Stacy came to that meeting, and during that meeting mentioned that she was going to have to travel back to her village in order to attend a funeral. And the mention of the village trip changed the tone of the conversation completely. The landlord started to ask her about her family's heritage and made a statement during the conversation that, you know, I've rented to natives before and they've always left me high and dry. And in the end, decided not to lease the apartment to her and her family.
But previously he'd been unable to tell. Is that the case?
Well, he hadn't. It had never come up until she had mentioned the trip to the village. Mm-hmm. Stacy went away from that a little bit perplexed about what to do next, but after consulting with various folks, decided that, yeah, I guess I've been discriminated against and I ought to do something about this. She wrote a commentary for our newspapers, and she did file a claim, a fair housing claim, with the State Human Rights Commission, which is in process.
And can you tell us how long those type of complaints take to resolve?
Well, knowing how our bureaucracy takes and how long it took to get emails to come to the fore, it's kind of hard to tell. But what we have seen a lot of is responses to her commentary from folks all around the state saying, you know, I've had a similar experience like this. And we've even had that reflected back to us from an attorney with the Native Rights Fund in Anchorage.
Well, what strikes me about this story is what I would see as unusual is the frankness of the landlord.
Yeah, he really didn't. There's kind of a no holes barred statements that he made.
And usually, what you get is after the revelation that somebody's a native. You know, I just realized my brother-in-law needs a place to stay.
Well, Stacy, she's pursuing this. She's actually was on the radio this morning talking about this, and she's getting support from the Alaska Native Brotherhood as she pursues her claim. And really, all she's looking for is to just shine light on this and let people know that this isn't right.
Okay, Tony, let's continue with you. The first endangered Alaska language to lose its last native speaker, maybe getting some help, and that maybe from an unusual place, France. Tell us about it.
Yeah, who would have thought? This weekend is at the Anchorage Museum is going to repeat an event that happened the previous weekend. This 22-year-old Frenchman, and forgive me if I mispronounce his name, my French isn't what it used to be, Guillaume Ledoux, is heading this up with help from a sociolinguist at UAA who specializes in intensive language training. What we have going on is a seminar for, it's open to the public, so anybody who's interested in learning EAC is welcome.
And where's this held?
This is going to be at the Anchorage Museum this weekend. And they spent the week in Cordova as well doing similar, basically 16-hour intensive language training for people who are interested in learning this language. The EAC language, based in the Prince William Sound area, lost its last full-blooded native EAC speaker in 2008 when Chief Marie Jones Smith died. Essentially, the language has been kept alive through Dr. Michael Krause from University of Alaska at Fairbanks, who has been studying this and developing it since the 60s. But this 22-year-old Frenchman, his story is probably the most interesting in this. He came to Alaska last year when he was 15 years old. He stumbled across the EAC language on the internet and decided, oh, I think I'm going to learn EAC. He's already multilingual, but he's studying on his own through DVDs provided by the support from the EAC Preservation Council in Cordova, has taught himself EAC. So now he's come to Alaska, second time now, in order to help other people learn the language.
This is pretty wonderful. Tony, do you know how many EAC speakers there might have been at the peak of the population and the breadth of the language?
No, I couldn't tell you.
Okay, thank you very much, Tony. Nice job. Paul, the special session of the Alaska legislature cost $1 million or so, and there are many taxpayers out there asking, okay, what did we get for $1 million? What are you going to tell them?
Nothing. You got zip, squat,
wait a
nada.
Minute. Tell us what you really feel.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They let the Coastal Zone Management Board sunset. They didn't get around to doing anything. They did a capital budget finally, I suppose. The House finally did its capital budget, dropped it in the Senate's lap, and went home. All of that could have been done 30 days previous, 60 days previous, 90 days previous. They didn't do that. So we're out $1 million for not much. Other than we're about to lose a very valuable
board. Well, they did pass a budget.
Well, they passed the budget. They have to pass
the capital budget.
Yeah,
but
eventually. What we're saying here is when they did it, they could have done it a month before. There was no change. The House didn't change. It just simply dropped it in the Senate's lap and went home.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, I was just going to follow up on what Paul says. Yeah, the big sticking point was the Senate says, put language in its capital budget that said, Governor Parnell, you're not allowed to, if you veto one energy project, you veto them all. And that was the big sticking point, the major sticking point. And in the end, they wound up giving up on that stance. The House erased it from their version of the budget, and the Senate said, well, okay. And then that was the end of it. So we couldn't have done that in the 90-day session. They couldn't come to that. It all should have been done within the first 90 days.
Steve, now, the legislators, if we approach them or the public approaches them back in their constituencies, they're going to say some version of, yeah, I know, but you don't understand the process, and yeah. I was all in favor of something else, and then something happened. The argument is kind of, well, it's just the nature of the beast.
I guess so, but everybody's talking about we've got to watch our money, we've got to watch our budget. I can understand if somebody's going to stand on principle and say, look, we can't do this because of these principles. This is going to harm the state because of this, this, and this. And in the end, it really didn't come out that way at all. It wasn't about principle. It was just like, oh, okay. That's the end of it, so let's move on. And the governor said, I won't go crazy with the veto pen. I'll look at these things one by one, and I just won't redline them all out of there. And, I think there's got to be some trust there as well. And in the end, no one really stuck up for any principles. Maybe the House did by saying that language that you've placed in the Senate version of the budget was wrong. So maybe the House did, and I don't know. I'd like to see them, Holly, how they're going to spend this.
I wouldn't be surprised if there's some legislators who are going to say, cost $1 million? Wait a minute. I saved you $2 million because, I held out to keep from spending the money on fill in the blank.
Yeah, maybe.
Tough sell?
Yeah, because I think Governor Parnell said, look, we got to keep an eye on our money. I want you to pass a budget that's about here. And they came in and passed a budget that's about there. So, it's going to be a tough sell.
Steve, authorities here in Anchorage, municipal authorities, are talking about and preparing to clean out the homeless camps now that they have legislation that allows them to do that in a way consistent with the law. When will that start? What's the outcome likely to be, and where do these people go?
Oh, good questions. When's it going to start? I'm not really sure. I guess in a way it's kind of started already. The police officers have gone by and into some of these homeless camps that are illegal, and they've placed tags on tents warning folks that this area is going to be cleared out. This is an illegal camp. You better find someplace else to be. Where they go, there are folks, obviously, there are a number of shelters that are around town, church organizations as well that are lending a hand, trying to help folks get off the street, but there are shelters certainly to help and lend a hand.
And there are going to be some people who kind of take the attitude, you can keep busting me, I'm just going to keep moving.
That's right. And I think that's why this is where it goes from here. I think this is a constant. This doesn't stop. It just keeps going and going, and we'll, you know, one of the things that the police department said in news releases and said to the media that, you know, the public is being urged to call them if they see an illegal camp somewhere. You know, there's the phone number out there. So, you know, I think this is going to be something that the police will be ever vigilant.
Sometimes the camp isn't much. There's been tents over by the Anchorage Daily News where people are in maybe for a while and then just go.
Yeah, right. So sometimes the camps are very mobile, and you know, you're right, there isn't very much there. But then there are camps that have been there for quite some time, and they take out tons and tons of trash.
I believe it.
Basically desecrate a green space in the city of Anchorage, and we've seen that happen a number of times as well. So I know it's difficult to talk about in a way, or you know, just you can't paint with a broad brush on this. Some folks just, this is a lifestyle. They want to live outside. They want to be on the street.
Yeah, and that's a very hard thing to understand for most people.
But they definitely want to be there. And they are respectful. I'm sure they are. And then there are places where it's very intimidating for people who want to ride their bike down the coastal trail or Chester Creek Trail or go for a walk or go into the woods or fish or whatever. It can be pretty intimidating as well.
Paul Jenkins, the Reapportionment Board has about finished its work reapportioning the Alaska Legislature. What's the latest?
They've got until Tuesday to finish this up for a final report. Then they've got 30 days for challenges. And I guess at that point it goes to the Department of Justice, which has to review it and okay it. It's made some several changes in the state. We've gotten in Southeast, they lose a House seat because of the different census numbers, and they lose half of a Senate seat. And then Mattsu gains a House seat. And part of this, a lot of this was done, if you look at some of the lines, it was done to protect Native voting rights, which was very high on the list of things to watch out for. The Justice Department's going to be very, very much on that. They did pretty well, I think. In the last such redistricting, there were 10 incumbents who found themselves on the outs because of the redrawing of the lines. When they redrew the lines this time, there were something like 5 incumbents now find themselves probably on the outside looking in. We've got several matchups. You've got Al Kukesh and Bert Stedman, Joe Pascavan and Joe Thomas in Fairbanks, both Democrats. And you got Chris Tuck and Mike Dugan in Anchorage, both Democrats, which if the lines stay the way they are, likely will wind up facing each other.
Unless some of these people moved.
Well, they'll either move or these things always go to court.
Yeah.
They're always settled by a judge, as in Alaska.
Until a judge
hammers it down on the gavel, until the Supreme Court says it's so, it's not so.
Tony Hall, a research project is now going on in rural Alaska to improve rural children's diets with traditional foods. Tell us how this program has been set up and how's it going to work.
Basically, Michael, this is a fish story, and we know in Alaska we love our fish stories. This program, it's being funded by about over $1 million grant from the USDA, which over the next 3 years, the Center for Alaska Native Health Research at UAF is going to be looking at how can we use traditional food, fish, traditional fish meals in different cafeteria situations and for school lunches. It's the goal of this is twofold: to improve nutrition while at the same time giving an opportunity for local businesses who want to produce certain types of fish food for school lunches can get involved and make these products work and provide them to schools. And basically, they're looking at this as a win-win situation.
And where's the project starting? What specific places?
Well, this is really in its infancy, so they have not picked the sites yet to where they're going to start working. But the first phase of it is going to involve talking with the people who are actually making the food for the children and finding out what do you see kids like? What are they eating? What will they eat?
And when will we know anything approaching results? I assume this takes years then, right?
It's funded. It's a 3-year grant. So again, it'll probably take about as long as it takes to get boxes of emails from the state.
We're out of time. We're out of time for boxes of emails or any other boxes. You'll have probably plenty of opportunity to read Palin emails on the web if that's what you want to do. They're out there by the 24,000. Thank you very much for joining us. See you next week right here on Alaska Edition.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.